Welcome back to Ask the Compound, where we have the best intro music of any podcast that runs on Thursday afternoons.
It's true.
It's good. This is a show where you send us the questions, we provide the answers. AskTheCompoundShow@gmail.com is our email. Today's show, we're discussing questions related to the difference between market timing and risk management, how to find a financial advisor, buying versus renting in Nashville, Tennessee. We're getting specific today. How hard it is to actually become a millionaire, and then the right glide path when you're trying to make your portfolio more conservative in retirement. Also, sign up for the Compound newsletter. I complained a couple weeks ago. I didn't have one of these fresh creamsicle Compound hoodies because I saw it on the Compound newsletter, right? We have, let's see, Mondays we have sometimes a special show. Tuesdays are What Are Your Thoughts? Wednesdays, Animal Spirits. Thursdays, Ask the Compound. Fridays, The Compound and Friends. It can be hard to keep up with everything, plus all of our blogs and such. So
yeah,
the Compound
newsletter. We keep you on your toes, right? So yeah, it's the only way to stay in the loop.
It's a nice summary. So what's the link? TheCompoundNews.com/subscribe.
That's it.
Tons of good stuff in there. Even check out some of our merch, idontshop.com. All right, let's do it. We got questions.
All right.
I got answers. Bring it.
Sounds good. Up first today, we have a question from Anthony. I listened to Ask the Compound episode 111 over the weekend, and Josh made a few comments that left me confused. He scoffed at the idea of market timing in investment portfolios, but then went on to explain the trade to add duration and fixed income as risk-reward analysis of possible economic outcomes. I'm having some trouble in my own portfolio defining for myself when to make any tilts. Is this finance speak, tilts? I don't think I've heard that.
Yeah, tilt is like making a small allocation change in your portfolio. Okay.
I don't want to market time individual stocks or anything in the short term, as I agree this is extremely difficult, but making bigger picture asset allocation tilts based on the economy or business cycle does seem prudent. How do you define market timing? When can tilts to a long-term asset allocation be made without being considered market timing?
Fair question. I look at it as a difference between market timing and risk management. So market timing is about predicting. Risk management is about preparing. Market timing assumes you know what's going to happen in the future. Risk management assumes you have no idea what's going to happen in the future, right? I think market timing is for people who think they're smarter than the market, which is very few of us. And then risk management is for people who know they're not smarter than the market. So fair question. On the show Josh was talking about, when Josh came on, he was talking about a move that we made in our portfolio. So I'm in the firm's investment committee, and our decision-making process, the way that we look at it is like the past is a pretty good guide to understand risks and ranges of outcomes, but you also have to look at the present to understand the risk-reward trade-off. So for instance, we don't ever try to predict which way rates are going to go. It's way too hard. There's too many variables. This is one of the first things I learned in this business. My boss told me, never ever try to predict rates because there's way too many variables. There's the Fed. There's foreign purchases of bonds. There's how people allocate their money. There's inflation and interest rates and economic growth and all these things. It's way too hard to predict where rates are going to go. I think that these last few years have been a pretty good real-world example of that. But I think you can assess the level of yield, the current level of yield, in relation to the risk and reward inherent in the different types of bond vehicles that you invest in. So during the pandemic, when the treasury yields all across the curve from 3 months to 30 years all fell below 1%, we decided it makes no sense to take that risk. Now, people were saying, well, yields could keep falling further and they could go negative, and that would be more bang for your buck in bonds. But we decided that the downside far outweighed any upside if rates did rise. So we moved to ultra short duration bonds. That wasn't an implicit prediction that rates are going to rise from here. It was saying the downside from rates rising is way worse than the upside you could get from rates falling a little bit more. So it was a risk reward trade-off kind of discussion, right? It was a decision. Just you weren't being compensated enough for the risk you were taking. And this was before T-bill yields were yielding 5%. This is back when T-bill yields were still close to zero. So it was more, we were just more comfortable being in short duration bonds because of that interest rate risk. We didn't predict the bond yields would go from 0% to 5%, but we did just look at the risk reward trade-off. So I think that was not based on our ability to predict the future. It was just asset allocation, market dynamics, and figuring out what the market is sort of giving you. So I think the idea is market timing requires you to be right twice. Like you have to when to get out and when to get back in. We never had any illusions when we did this change that we were going to be timing the market, hitting the top perfectly and hitting the bottom perfectly or whatever it is. So call it market timing if you want, but that's just more of a risk-reward trade-off. So the way I look at it is like rebalancing is not market timing. It's a way to keep your portfolio in line with your static risk levels, changing your asset allocation as you age or your circumstances change, that's not market timing. That's just taking into account changes in your situation. So I think that's the kind of way to think about it. Market timing is more about like, I'm planning for this outcome. Risk management is more about the process of making good decisions over and over again, regardless of the outcome. That's the way that I look at it.
Some of this is subjective though, right? It's up to the individual. Like before we went live, I was talking about a holding I've had for 3 months as a longer term holding. And you made the comment that that's not a long-term holding.
Yes, you could say it's splitting hairs, but I think it's more about having a good decision-making process as opposed to like, I'm gonna go all in or I'm gonna go all out. And if this doesn't happen in the next month, that sort of thing, where you're trying to put a timing and a magnitude on something, that's the hard part about market timing is not only the magnitude of the move, it's did you get the timing right? That's the part that I always try to stay away from is I think because of what the Fed's gonna do, interest rates are going to rise in the next 6 weeks. So I'm going to put this trade on. Like that stuff is so hard to do.
I think the scariest story that you guys have talked about in this regard is people who got out, you know, back a decade ago and still, you know, aren't fully back in the market or missed out on massive gains in the market because
all these people say, listen, I got out in 2007 and I thought I was a genius. And then fast forward in 2016, and it's round-tripped and higher than where I got out of, and I'm still sitting in cash.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
That's rough.
That kind of stuff. All right, let's do another one.
All right, up next, we have a question from Giancarlo, who some of you might know from the chat. Giancarlo
regular in the live chat, right?
Regular. So my BIL, which took us a minute because we were thinking of our friends, sponsors at US Benchmark, BIL, their ETF, but brother-in-law. My brother-in-law is in the music industry and has done well for himself. He was even lucky enough to attend the Grammys as he manages a prominent songwriter who was up for the major awards this year. We were talking this weekend and I found out he is a 1099 self-employed contractor technically, but he doesn't have anything really set up to help with taxes or retirement plans. I told him to find a CFP and look into setting up a SEP IRA. I also advised him to save every receipt from travel, airfare, lodging, dinner, etc., as these are business expenses. The issue is he doesn't know much about finances, but has and will come into large windfalls from time to time. Second page. How does someone go about finding a CFP? Is there a rating system? Is performance published? I'd love to send him your way, but it got me thinking, I don't even know your track record. I think you guys are great, so it's not a slight, but a general question. How do you handle someone who's very well off but has very little patience for finance? As an engineer, I'm comfortable with numbers, math, and finance, but I understand how more creative types gloss over when talking about financial planning. I just got to say, I relate to the last part. There are very few creatives who are also into the stock market or, you know, finance. And so we're like a very small little club.
Yes. The Venn diagram of people who went to film school and also own Oatly stock is one person. You.
Probably. It's probably not many.
So you want to know how I know I'm washed as a pop culture person, because my daughter wanted to watch the Grammys this year because she's the biggest Taylor Swift fan in the world. And I didn't know who any of these people were. No, I knew you could tell me the name of the artist, play their song, show me their picture, and I still wouldn't know who they were. I might have known 10% of the people. So this sort of not to brag about having a Grammy artist is right over my head because I know none of the artists anymore. I'm washed. I listen to music that was from my time still, basically. So the way that I think of this is one of the biggest changes we've seen in the U.S. economy in the last 70 years or so is a transition from a goods-based economy to a service-based economy. John, give me a chart on our first one of the day. This just shows employment in manufacturing versus employment in service professions since the 1940s. And you can see manufacturing kind of stalled out for a while and basically went nowhere. And now it's been falling in the past few decades as we offshore and become more efficient. And people in the services business looks like a chart of the stock market, just bottom left to top right over time. So the strange thing about service businesses is that it's not tangible. It's not, especially with something like financial services, you don't get an end product that you can hand to someone and say, look what I built for you. Here it is. Pay me money for this. There's no finished product. And I always say financial planning is a process that never really ends. And it's especially at the beginning, it's based exclusively on trust, right? So how do you find someone? How do you figure out who you can trust in the services-related business? Well, you can shop around a little bit, do your research. Unfortunately, there is no rating system. This is not like the NFL draft. We don't have a combine. That's
what I was going to say. I mean, there are technically, if you Google, there are like rankings and things like that, but those are completely subjective. They're not like actually based on any data or anything, right?
And if we're being honest, these financial advisors are telling their friends and family members to give me a good rating.
Right.
I don't know how much you can. And a lot of the ratings in like the papers and the barons or whatever, those are pay to play too. So let's be honest with how those ratings work. I mean, I don't know. Word of mouth helps. Tell your brother-in-law to ask other people in his position what they do, who they work with. Maybe they have some people who are niche in the music profession who work with creative types. And then you ask questions, you know, what kind of services they provide? Are they happy with their advisor? How does that relationship work? I think one of the difficult aspects of a service-based industry, especially in finance, if you're not into the finances very much like we are, is that the people who are the best sales people are often they're not always the best at their craft. Like they're not the biggest experts, but you always want to work with someone who makes a good sales pitch. I mean, sometimes you get both, but it's actually kind of rare. So as far as I'm concerned, the biggest differentiator in this industry is transparency. So how much are they willing to tell you about fees and portfolios and systems and how the relationship will operate over time? That's the sort of stuff that I think can help build trust. All of our advisors walk prospects through a financial planning process before they ever even become clients. And then it's like, here's the financial plan we created for you. Do you want to become a client? We can implement it for you. Because that's the biggest part of it. It's not the plan itself, it's implementation. So I also think it helps to understand like what sort of services an advisor can provide for you. And then once you're armed with all that knowledge, you can like make a more informed decision. That's the kind of stuff that you'd be looking for. And I think since your brother-in-law is not into finance as a creative person, that education and communication should play a really big role in the advisors that you choose. It's not someone who says, trust us, we got this. You go do your music thing and we can handle it. You need someone who's going to communicate effectively and educate them on like what they're doing for you and why they're doing it. So otherwise, it's going to be really easy to take advantage of you and not really know what's going on in the portfolio or the plan.
Yeah, I mean, to me, as a non-finance person, it would be really important to have someone who is willing to actually explain what's going on, what they're doing, and you know, work with you instead of just being like, you know, just forget about it. We'll take care of that. That seems to me.
And that's the important part is you can outsource portfolio management. You can outsource tax expertise and estate planning, but you can't outsource your understanding of what's going on there. Right. You always have to kind of be in the know and just like, okay, you're doing this or you make this recommendation, but why are you making this recommendation for me? That's the stuff you got to understand.
And talking about a personality type too, I heard Adam Gray on a podcast. He had this great line where he said, confidence does not equal competence. And he was talking about how in boardrooms across the country, traditionally, people who are the loudest, most confident are the ones that get promoted and get the spotlight and that kind of thing, and how that is not a recipe for success. And we should change our thinking on that. So yeah.
But that's what people want in finance. They want confidence. They want someone to tell them, I know exactly what's going to happen, so come with me. And that's not the way it should be.
Right, right.
All right, next question.
Hey, up next we have a question from Connor. My fiance and I live in Nashville. She's a dentist and I'm a lawyer. We can easily afford a home, not to brag, I added that, but buying seems substantially more expensive than renting in this market. Nashville is seeing record multifamily housing deliveries.
There you go.
Yeah, MFH deliveries, and has about 20% apartment vacancy rates with many new apartments being built. This is pushing down rents and many lease incentives are being offered to renters. Our loan officer sent us a loan estimate this week. On a $550,000 property, we'd finance $522,000 at 7.15%. With that loan, we'd pay about $50,000 in year one. $5,000 of that would go toward principal, the remainder to interest, PMI, insurance, and property tax. PMI is mortgage insurance, right?
Yep, private mortgage insurance. We talked about that before.
Okay, cool. Given we could rent a very nice apartment downtown for about $34,000 over the next year or $3,800 a month with a three-month free lease incentive, does it make more sense to just continue renting?
Okay, we've been getting a handful of these questions, especially from places in like Nashville and Austin, where they've seen this glut of apartments being built and people saying, whoa, I'm actually getting a pretty good deal here, I think. Maybe I don't need to buy. Good timing on this. So let's bring in Nick Majuli from Dollars and Data, who actually just wrote a post on this. Should you rent or buy a house? Right, Nick?
Yes. Thank you for bringing me on.
So you wrote this blog post and you ran the numbers, you're a number guy, and you actually created a Google Doc spreadsheet?
Yeah, I wanted to make Google it as Sheets? Easy as possible. I could have like built a whole calculator on the site, but I just thought it was too much. And I wanted people to actually see the month by month. So I think I create a free Google sheet you can just download. You guys can probably link to that later. I create a separate one just for this example so we can walk through some of the numbers. So
walk me through some of the stuff you tried to figure out in terms of the rent versus buy decision. What are your inputs you're using here?
Yeah, so the main, here's how I want to just think about in terms of a framework. Like, let's think about the framework first. And I think of this as two different bags of money, right? There's the value of the home. You buy the home today. Let's assume you have a 30-year fix. Let's just assume that for now. You pay it off over 30 years and then you sell it in 30 years. Exactly, that's it. You buy the home, you sell it. So the only way the homeowner makes money is when they sell the home in 30 years, okay? The other bag of money is what the renter would pay now going forward and then any savings they have, like basically if their rent is lower than the mortgage, that's a savings in the beginning, right? But if their rent goes up, then it's like an anti-saving or it's the opposite, it's a cost, right?
And so there's the idea that they'll save the difference or invest it?
Yeah, they'll save the difference and invest in a portfolio. So in what John's showing, there's a portfolio value. You see that in column D, and then there's a home value in green. Those are the two bags of money right now, right? And there's a lot of assumptions about inflation, a lot of stuff which we can get into. I want to actually talk about this particular example first and then get into kind of how these different parameters affect it. So just on the numbers he gave us, Connor gave us, he said, okay, he's doing basically 5% down payment on a $550,000 home, right? So he's financing about, you know, $522,000. If you do it at that rate he gave, it's roughly about $3,500 a month, right, for that mortgage. When you add in, you know, property tax, you see this in column F, there's the property tax, maintenance, insurance. That gets to around $4,400 a month. You can see that in column E, the buying cost, $4,402. And he said he's paying about $50,000 a year. If you actually do the $4,400 times 12, it's like $52,000. So I'm close. My estimate's close to what he's saying. But what this shows is, let's say you paid that. You paid the $4,400 a year, no inflation. I'm going to use no inflation first because it's the most extreme case, and then we can kind of mess with the numbers after that. But if you were to do that, just $4,400 a year, you pay that for the next 30 years. At the end, you sell the home exactly what you bought it at for $550, right? If you compare that to the rental savings you would have by just renting and doing that going forward and taking that extra savings, because you save about, as you can see, about $500 a month by not buying, and you invest that, it's actually less than what the home would be worth. So in this
case— That's surprising me. I would have thought it would have been the opposite for this one.
Yeah, well, what it's showing, though, I am assuming a 4% portfolio growth rate. Remember, that's above inflation. So this assumes a world of no inflation. So this is a 4% real return. Obviously, the U.S. stock market has returned historically 7%. I don't know if I want to make that assumption going forward. I think 4% is conservative on a diversified portfolio. 4% real return.
Well, and the other thing is, you don't know how many people are actually going to save that difference, right? If someone said, I'm paying $3,800 a month in rent, but I could be paying $4,500 a month or whatever it is for my mortgage— not everyone's going to even save that difference.
Yeah.
So you're including that, and it still says buying is a better decision.
Yeah. And so once you actually, I'm going to actually update this. So when you see how this works generally, the higher inflation is, the more it's going to push towards being a homeowner. Because remember, once you lock in your mortgage, it might suck. It might be high early, but once you lock that in, that's locked in for 30 years. So if you start
having it's a wonderful inflation hedge.
Yeah, it's an incredible inflation hedge. So once, if you start kicking up the inflation, your rent's going to keep going up and the home value, we assume, just move in lockstep with inflation, right? Assuming that goes up, like you'll see, I'm just going to change this number. I'm hoping it updates real quick. I'm not sure if John will see it in real time, but I just updated it. And now you can see the home value now goes. So if you assume 3.8%, which is the historical inflation rate going back to like 1940, 3.8% per year, you do that. In 30 years, that $550,000 home is going to be $1.67 million.
And you're just assuming that the house goes up by the rate of inflation.
Yep, that's it. Every year,
so it's
just
not like
goes up
like you're assuming monthly, some crazy housing gains or anything.
Just standard 3.8. And we can put this lower. That's what I'm saying. Even at a 0% inflation rate, buying slightly edges out renting. And now you're saying, well, Nick, how's the portfolio value negative? This doesn't even make sense. Like, how can the portfolio value be negative? Well, what's happening in this case is some point along the line, as you're saving money early on, you see that extra savings, it's $500 a month, it starts to go down pretty quickly. I think the break-even point here is about 40 months in, you are now paying exactly what you'd be paying. So you can see the break-even, right there as you come down. So at about, 53 months, I guess, you're basically break-even. You're paying the same per month that a homeowner would be paying. Remember, because your homeowner cost goes up because of inflation as well. Remember, maintenance goes up, all those types of things go up. But because we've locked in that mortgage, that doesn't change. So you'll see at some point your rent keeps going up and up. And so by the very end, if John wants to go to the very end, you can see 30 years from now, with 3.8% inflation, you would be paying for that same apartment roughly $11,000 a month. I know that seems crazy right now, but historically, that's kind of what would have happened.
So you could also take this and say, okay, fine, $550, but what if I jacked it up and I got a little more and I wanted to get a bigger house or better house and I got a $650,000 house, a $750,000? So you could play with the numbers and kind of figure out what makes the most sense.
Yeah, I think in this particular instance, it's a screaming buy. Like anytime you have the mortgage is below the rent, like that's usually really weird. I did my example in my post where I'm in New York and the mortgage is like $3,000 more than the rent. And in this case, it would be below, which is
right.
Like—
rarely in a place like San Francisco or New York, like a super high cost of living area, rarely is buying going to be a better deal, right?
Yeah. And the other thing to take into account, well, where does this fail? Okay, let's say the house price drops a lot over time, but you can model that. You can say, let's drop it by 4% a year. You can make the negative, you can do a deflation on the house and still see where it ends up. And so I think you have to make some pretty interesting assumptions to get to not buying in this case.
The thing that's a killer in the New York City area is for that price range, you're looking at like a tiny condo, right? And and there's a massive homeowner's fee that can go up over time and you have no sense of where it's going to be.
That's true. You probably get a little bit of better bang for your buck in a place like Nashville than you do in New York.
Right.
Or the outskirts.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Oh,
for
yeah. Sure. Easily. Yeah.
And then just imagine if they rented out the garage on Airbnb.
Oh, my goodness.
That's true. Okay. So, Nick, we'll include a link to this on YouTube as well.
That was awesome.
So people can kind of play around with that themselves. So, let's do another one.
Okay. Up next, we have a question from John. Nick's blog seems to show that $1 million is a hard goal. My wife and I made it in 16 years on $80,000 combined gross with an all-stock portfolio starting in 1985. Okay, so I got to partake in the dot-com run-up, but I also rode through Black Monday and the ensuing dot-com bust and lost decade to retire in 2019. I know I'm a more aggressive investor than most, and maybe I was a little fire before that was a thing. Generally, we maxed out IRAs and 401ks, plus a little in brokerage accounts. Am I just blowing smoke at kids I coach if I tell them 20% savings rate invested annually and actual stock market returns over 40 years actually makes $1 million more often than not?
So, Nick, this was a blog post you wrote, and you talked about how a lot of people in personal finance say, listen, if you just start saving X amount of money at age 25 and wait till you're 60 or 65, you will be a millionaire. And it sounds like such easy advice to take. And your point was, yeah, that sounds great, but it's a lot harder than it seems, especially in your 20s when other stuff is coming up and it's not so easy to save from that point in time.
Yeah, if you actually look at people's incomes and how much they tend to save, and I'm actually looking at actual data of Americans that saved over time using historical data, like, yeah, the typical American does not get anywhere near $1 million, but then someone could argue, well, the typical American isn't saving 20%. So to answer this question, I would say, I don't think you're blowing smoke at all, but I think saving 20% every year for 40 years, I don't think that's easy for most people. So, or even any 30
especially
year
in
period,
your Especially in your 20s, I think, just starting out, that's the hard part. And that's when the biggest gains from compounding happen is the earlier you start, because the longer you go, those gains have more to build. Yeah. And I think the number, if we're talking liquid, take housing out of the situation, I think this is a few years ago, this number might be a little stale, but I think it's 5% of Americans are millionaires, something like that, 10, maybe 12, if you include housing. It's not a huge number, right, that actually can make it. It's one out of 20, maybe.
Yeah, it's a smaller percentage. But the other issue, too, is like inflation. So like $1 million isn't even like today, if you're a millionaire today, you would need, like, I think when I like to look at when did millionaire status kind of blow up, I think it was around 2000. It was the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. That's when kind of that language got in our culture a bit. And so compared to then, you would need about $1.8 to almost $2 million today to be in that same like kind of relative wealth given changes in inflation. So it's not that $1 million isn't, $1 million still a lot of money. I don't want to downplay that at all and sound out of touch, but it's not what it was when I think this whole kind of, oh, I'm a millionaire culture started. So do I think people are going to become millionaires? Yes, I think it's going to keep happening just because of inflation alone, let alone anything else. But I do think you have to go a little bit above and beyond. I think 20% a year is more than most Americans save. And so I think that's why it is kind of
the one place though that no one pegs to inflation. Like a million, it's always kind of a status symbol, regardless.
That's what I was gonna ask.
The two comma club.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna ask. Is it seems like a million has been the number for a long time. People are like $1 million is the baseline what you should aspire to have in retirement. but I feel like that's not really changed. Is it just because it's such a nice round number, $1 million?
Yeah, that's completely it. That's my guess, right? It's easier. Oh no, it's $2 million now. Well, it probably is $2 million now, but like, what are we gonna, sit here and be like, oh, I'm the $2 millionaire club? Doesn't even make, it sounds weird, yeah, right? It sounds so particular, right?
True.
So
yes. Right. And I will give credit to John who wrote in here for doing this and being one of those people who followed like the personal finance book to a T and maxed out the retirement accounts. And I think that's admirable. But I do think, to your point, Nick, it's a lot harder for most people than it sounds.
Yeah, I actually think, I thought about this a little, I think multimillionaire is the new millionaire in that sense, because then all you need is two, right?
So. True. That's true. I have multiple. All right, one more question.
All right, last but not least, we have a question from Steve. Nick has done a lot of good work on dollar cost averaging, but how about some glide path research? I'm in my late 40s trying to consider how to slowly diversify an all-stock retirement portfolio. Is it better to just rip the Band-Aid off and immediately move to an 80-20 portfolio, or do so over time, something like 2% a year for 10 years?
Okay, so this, we've actually been getting a handful of questions like this. I feel like we have a good, decent middle-age contingency here. Like, you know, early to late 40s, early 50s, who are thinking like, you know, I've been doing fine, I've been saving, but I know at some point I need to diversify. I'm guessing the simple answer, Nick, would be because of your dollar cost averaging and lump sum research, the slower you do it, the better in terms of returns. That would make sense theoretically.
Yep, that's it right there. I think the only other things to consider, I mean, that's the theoretical solution. The only other thing to consider are tax. So like, if you're like, oh, I want to move now, or tax and risk. So if you're thinking like, oh, I'm really worried about risk, the market crashing, like you might want to move sooner. But if you do that, there could be a tax hit depending on how your assets, where they're allocated. Are they in, you know, retirement accounts, qualified accounts, non-qualified accounts, et cetera. And so obviously going from 100-0 to 80-20 is the lowest risk thing to do, all else equal, but it also could have more tax implications. So yeah, I completely agree. I think doing it slowly is fine. It's just there is more risk of doing that. Just like in the opposite, when I say, hey, lump sum, put it all in now, of course, there's technically more risk of doing that. But, you know, 75, 80% of the time, you're going to outperform, right, by doing that. So that's something to keep in mind.
There really isn't a ton of glide path research. I found this one piece by Michael Kitsis. He wrote this a number of years ago. And his whole thing was, as you approach retirement, you actually want to jack your bonds up faster. So, John, throw this chart up here. He kind of shows where the risk is. And he's saying that the biggest risk for anyone in retirement, this is when you're entering retirement, is having a huge bear market right when you retire, right? Which is kind of funny because the last guy, John, who said he retired in 2019, he got a bear market in 2020, then one in 2022, but it didn't really matter because they were so short. But having an extended bear market at retirement. So John, throw the next chart up here. So what he says is what you should do is actually decrease your equity exposure as you hit those retirement years. And then after the first, I don't know, call it 3 to 5 years of retirement, if you survive that lot of bear market, then you slowly increase your equity exposure. And it kind of provides you a cushion in case things are bad there. So that's kind of like assuming the worst case outcome, which I think is how a lot of retirees think about it. Johnny can do chart off, but I'm kind of curious for your thoughts on that, for like planning the, because everyone always thinks, listen, it might have gone fine for everyone else and they ended up finding retirement, but me, I'm going to retire and then the stuff's going to hit the fan and it's going to be the worst timing ever. What do you think about that kind of strategy?
No, I think it makes sense. I also, we only live in this lifetime. I can't live in the average lifetime or the average result, right? And so because of that, I think it makes sense that if you wanted to rapidly, you know, increase fixed income right into retirement and then go down from there. Obviously, this person, they said they were in their late 40s. So another option you can do, I mean, if you're still saving money, so if you're like, hey, I want to retire, I want to move into this, how do I do it? Like, instead of selling anything, just buy only fixed income going forward. Like, just keep putting all your new money into fixed
income. Yeah, your contributions.
Yeah, I call this an accumulation rebalance because you're just accumulating all your underweight assets. That's a way where you don't have to sell anything. You don't have to worry about that. Of course, it depends on how much, it's always relative to how much income you have coming in. If you don't have a lot of income coming in, this is really tough. Or as your portfolio gets really large, this becomes very difficult. But that is another way of doing this, is just buying fixed income until you're at, okay, if I do this within X years, I should be at my 80-20 target and I don't have to touch anything in my other accounts if there's tax implications, for example.
And I've heard retirees who've written us in who said, like 2, 3, 4 years before retirement, all my contributions, I just put them in cash. And that's like my buffer heading into retirement. And that's the kind of thing I guess you want to think about. So that's, yeah. But it's true. There isn't, I mean, because the target date funds have their glide path, but there isn't a lot of research on this actual topic. It's kind of squishy gray area for a lot of people to know what to do and when to do it.
Yeah, maybe I can write a blog on this. We'll see. So
all right, run some numbers for us. Checkout of dollars and data from Nick. Nick sends out a weekly newsletter, which is great. It's his work, but also what you provide a visualization and a couple of good reads you've been doing. So that's always good. Buy Nick's book if you haven't yet.
I think everyone's already bought his book.
Yeah,
if you look at the numbers
in Japan, and everyone in Japan has, maybe not America, but we'll leave it at that. So
good for them. Even after they're the one example, they're still buying it.
Well, yeah, they're in a bull market, man.
You can't say Now Show Japan anymore because they run. Yeah,
it's true. Hey Ben, before we get out of here, how's your bracket doing?
I have no idea. I last place maybe.
Well, I know you're in 15th, and I'm in like 23rd. So
15th out of how many?
Like 30 something. So,
okay,
you know,
so I'm median.
Middle of the pack. Yeah, yeah,
I'll take it.
I saw we both picked UConn, so we'll see. Let's see.
Okay, yeah, that's like having Apple be your largest stock holding.
Right.
But
yeah, yeah. I should have been a little more out there, I guess.
Okay. Idontshop.com for this sweet compound sweatshirt if you want and other stuff there. Don't forget to subscribe, like, leave us a review. Maybe we'll read some reviews in the future. And we'll see you next time.
See everyone.
Thanks for listening to Ask the Compound. All opinions expressed by Ben Carlson, Duncan Hill, and any of their guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.